Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Tales to Terrify.
Good evening, children of the night. Welcome to the Nook, to Tales to Terrify. See, I told you last week, you survived it, the week. It went quickly, and here we are, all together again. Yes, the air is on, but what are you going to do? Almost 2 weeks of mid to upper 90s, days here and there where the temperature oozed to over 100 plus degrees and the humidity was right there on its tail. Well, settle in. Grab something chilly. We've got some great things for you this evening. First, I want you to listen to this.
Do you like science fiction? Do you like theater? Then Blastoff is a show for you. A night of theater so sci-fi-tastic it takes kitchen sink drama and adds in a replicator. A night where breaking the fourth wall could mean the collapse of the multiverse. And a night where you'll see short plays by award-winning writers Gabriel Wisenschmidt, Joshua Conkle, and star of Channel 4's stand-up of the week, Sarah Pascoe. Blast Off, boldly going where no show has gone before. To the Soho Theatre in London, July 10th, 7 p.m. Engage!
Here's a little more information. Blast Off is fresh from its first sellout show, and this latest episode brings together a new lineup of science fiction plays by five of the best new writers in theater. Curated by sci-fi nerd Jonathan Britton and theater nerds Lucy Jackson and Claire Turner, Blast Off features work by award-winning writers Gabriel Bissett-Smith, Sarah Pascoe, and Joshua Conkle, as well as comedy from John Luke Roberts. So, if you like science fiction, like theater, like replicants, like the end title music from Independence Day, and how appropriate is that this 4th of July week here in the nearly united former colonies, and how inappropriate for a British company to be using it. And if you're able to get to London before July 10, I know you'll be in the Soho Theater that night, 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, for Blast Off. Okay, are you settled now? And now, a second thing. Yes, the art on our site, it's new. If you're on the internet machine, go take a peek at this month's cover. It's called Red Depths, red as July should be, watery as July should be, chilly and fraught as, well, as every time, all time should be. The piece is by an old friend, Skeet Sienski, from the Starship Sofa. The Skeet did the cover art for the first Starship Sofa Stories book. It was an image so intriguing that several people in the forum suggested that it needed to have a story of its own. I was fool enough to quietly mention that, well, gee, well, maybe I'll do something with it someday. And, of course, Tony grabbed me and said, do it, and we'll cast it and publish it to help raise money for a good cause. And the story turned out to be Lord Dickens' declaration. And at 25,000 words, the thing took 3 episodes of the Starship to narrate, and the published story involved adding 4 more illustrations to make it all pretty, and that was, nearly 3 years ago. And since then, Skeets, well, he's taken the reins as the art director and cover layout designer for the Starship, as well as for Tales to Terrify. A few words, Skeet got his start in podcast art thanks to Tony Smith and the book cover of the short story The Daffodil Train. That snowballed him into illustrating the first year of the Starship Sofa's monthly covers, as well as for the Starship Sofa volumes 1, 2, and 3. Somewhere in there came Lord Dickens' declaration, and Skeet lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, USA, and is the owner of Beyond the Disc, a disc golf art illustration business. Yes, disc golf or frisbee golf, depending on where you live. That's a sport that uses those funny-looking baskets with chains hanging on them. You might see them in public parks. A fair sample of his work can also be found on the fabulous Drabblecast. Skeet says, the inspiration for Red Depth, that's the picture we've got up, is from a dream. He says, not much scares me, though sometimes dreams that project a feeling of vast size, such as this creature's red eye bursting forth from the inky black depths of the ocean, sends waves of terror through my mind. Well, yeah, isn't it grand? Usually this generates a scream that thankfully wakes me, he says. If you'd like to contact Skeet for any occasion or a custom illustration, you can reach him at www.beyondthedisc.com or find him and his art on Facebook under his profile, Skeet Disc Golf Art Sienski. And he spells his name S-C-I-E-N-S-K-I. We have tonight a special treat. Yeah, okay, you're right. Everything here in the Nook is a special treat, except when Mahler, the ink-black cat of the Nook, is suddenly there, snuggled up to you invisibly, and he opens his golden eyes, and you see him, and, well, you can imagine. But tonight, we'll present our first ever 10 Terrifying Minutes. This week, we'll present a fragment from Drake Vaughan's novel, The Zombie Generation, from Dead Orb Press. We'll have more about that in the end of the evening. Our main fiction tonight is from Stephen Volk. Stephen Volk's first collection of short stories, Dark Corners, appeared in 2006, and more recently his novella, Varadodger, earned him a nomination for both a Shirley Jackson Award and a British Fantasy Award. We'll have more information and some news about him later. He can be reached at www.stephenvolk.net. That's STEPHENVOLK.net. Here is Stephen Volk's
After the Ape. It was difficult for her to function with any kind of normality. Not when her lover was lying below, crisscrossed by ropes like Gulliver, people hacking out the insides of his body like whalers from Nantucket. She'd taken to having her first cigarette while still horizontal, sucking in her already sunken cheeks, drifting into the penumbra of being fully awake. The morning newspaper was always lying outside her door, but she didn't read it anymore. Always full of stuff she didn't want to hear. Stuff that made her feel angry and sickened. Him. Herself. The lies. The legend. The jungle. What did they know about the jungle? They hadn't been there. None of them had. In time, the salty soreness of her tears compelled her to sit up in the cold of the hotel room, icy shoulders trembling, tiny arms frozen and white. Doll eyes stared from the mirror. She hadn't set foot outside it for how many days now? How many weeks? She didn't care. The room was safe. She was untouchable there, alone with her menagerie of thoughts and memories. Sometimes she wondered if she left or was made to leave. Those thoughts and memories might remain, like ghosts, her misbegotten soul haunting the building, while her physical body was wheeled away on a gurney, nothing left of her but a soft-focus studio publicity shot and an obit in Variety. Somehow she knew how the headline would go. What did they know? They knew shit. That was the Bowery girl talking. That's what she was, after all, down to her raggedy-ass bones, and none of the glamour and pearls and platinum curls of Hollywood could cover that up for her in the end. Once a bum, always a bum. She unscrewed the cap from the bourbon. Papa's favorite. Prohibition. Joke. There were ways. The tumbler told her it hated to be half full. The numb, plummeting wash of it brought up an acid reflux that hauled her monstrous hangover with it, dispelling any faint illusion her head was clear. Still, she was grateful for a taste of oblivion. Oblivion was her prime concern of late. Any other concern, eating, sleeping, dressing, fell poor second. What could you do when the hangover felt like it would kill you? Keep drinking. Truth is, she barely even tasted it anymore. On her wrist, a gift from a producer who had a taste in watching instead of doing said 11:45. Hell. Not that she'd missed anything, just that so much of the goddamn day loomed ahead of her. These days she despised being awake, because being awake meant thinking, and thinking meant remembering. Twig fingers tweaked at the drapes. She knew sunlight was going to be painful on skeleton skin, but managed to let a gap of a few inches illuminate the scrunched-up sheets, the full ashtrays, the dirty glasses, the scattered shoes, the half-hung clothes, the latest Paris fashion fur coat strewn on the floor, where it would lie forever if she had her way. Fur. Those insensitive bastards at the studio. Fur. Last time she listened to the radio, it was saying that they were giving tours of him now, taking folks on tours inside him now. She pictured his chest cavity lit by strings of lamps like Jewel Cave in Custer, South Dakota, she remembered visiting as a frightened, inexpressive, barefoot child. She knew they'd take out her insides, too, if they could. The birds of prey of the Herald and Times, the graveyard worms and rats in raincoats with underwoods where their morals should be. The story. It was all about getting the story. And the story was her. And sometimes in the darkness of night and nicotine with the shakes and spiders, giant, huge, it was oh so appealing sometimes to say, "Here I am, you sons of bitches, do with me what you will. Here I am, chained, naked, shrieking. And then it'll be over and I'll have peace." But this wasn't just about her. It was about the special thing that she and her lover had found and lost in a heartbeat, a great heartbeat like a jungle drum, and it was that they wanted to stamp all over with their dirty thoughts and bad jokes and fabrications, and she wouldn't let them. It was too precious, too rare, too wonderful. Too strange, too romantic, too scary. She wouldn't let them abuse it, and she wouldn't let them have it to do with as they pleased. It belonged to her. It was all she had left. That and the feeling as she slumbered that once again her lover's giant fingers were closing warmly around her body, and she was safe again. It was the one thing, the giant thing they could never, ever destroy. Not with airplanes, not with anything. She heard the beeping of taxicabs from the street far below. The traffic was moving. The traffic always moved. She wanted to open the window, but she daren't. The streets of Manhattan still ran sweet with blood, the oceanic stench of decay. A graveyard upended, said the radio, hung heavy in the air, and even as the lumberjacks and slaughtermen changed shifts day in, day out, nothing could be done to diminish it. It was a brave tourist indeed among the throng of sightseers from every state in the Union, who wouldn't hold their nose or cover their lower face with a handkerchief when viewing the colossal remains, this wonder of the world, this hairy behemoth, this Goliath slain by David. Goosebumps rose on her arms. She picked up her dressing gown embossed with the hotel's elaborate crest and wrapped it around her shoulders. It gave her the warmth of a surrogate embrace. The bourbon, telling her, "Don't be shy," gave her another. It didn't improve on the first, instead made her feel sour and queasy, mingling with the disquiet she felt in her nerves, and far from acting as an anesthetic as she prayed, made her even more anxious with the hermetic silence of the room. Not suddenly, but with conviction, she realized the very real possibility that she'd go mad here and be carted to the nuthatch or end up howling at the wallpaper or running out into Fifth Avenue half-naked like Mrs. Partigan, who lost her brain and took to going shopping on icy winter nights wearing nothing but her undies and would be chauffeured home by Raleigh Absalom, the local deputy, with admirably sanguine regularity. That was in Marshall, Nebraska, where she grew up, cold and unhappy, raised under the jurisdiction of her Aunt Jelly after Ma's last illness. She wished she'd seen her mother before she died. But Bryce was on the scene by then, and Bryce and her didn't get along, which was like saying the war in Europe was a difference of opinion. So Dollface, porcelain and pure, skipped off school, never did like it, got beat a lot, and hopped on a cattle train to New York like a hobo. But her ma was already in the ground, and Bryce was damned if he'd pay the return fare, so she earned that singing on street corners and in various other manners, with a pair of goodish legs and a singing voice that got her by. It was a tough climb, and mostly she counted herself lucky if she made it to the soup kitchen every day. Hoofer, chorus girl, arm candy for a rich guy, good time Annie for the distracted and misunderstood. Wasn't too choosy. Couldn't afford to be. When you slept on a doorstep in the pouring rain, you didn't ask to see a resume. If the collar was clean, or if there was a collar, the feller was plenty good enough for you. For a night, anyhow. Especially if he was paying for a bed. They started saying she should be in movies, and she heard that so many times it turned out to be true. She was good at acting. Every day of her goddamn life. Tired of her own prehistory, she sat on the side of the bed and rang down for room service. The hotel operator's voice was chirpy and infantile, making her wonder if the girl was retarded. Nobody could be that happy, unless maybe she was on the bourbon, too. She had a difficult time with the words, so she stayed monosyllabic. Ham, bread, eggs. The girl repeated back her order, making it sound much more coherent, and said it would be 20-25 minutes. "Is there anything else I can help you with, ma'am?" The actress spooled through a list of requests in her mind. A life? Happiness? But said, "No, just that." Hung up, thinking, did she know? Of course she knew. They all did, probably snickering up her sleeve right now, calling her boyfriend, eager with the gossip. "Guess who we've got staying? No, yes!" The idea of food made her think of the slabs of meat being shorn off her lover's corpse. The two-man saws at work under the same hefty spotlights the studio wheeled out for the big night at that Broadway theater when he was shown to the public for the very first time, before all hell broke loose. She thought of the massive steaks being packed in ice trucks and sent to the deprived, the poor, the needy. There were placards out there saying it was near as God cannibalism, but the hungry didn't care. The homeless didn't debate. The jobless didn't grumble. Her lover had died, and his flesh was being used to feed the poor. There was something desperately Christian in that, but wholly blasphemous at the same time. When it came, the knuckle rap on the door was brisk, snapping her blank stare. Another glass since the phone call, pointless but effortless. She tucked her breasts inside her robe and tightened the belt with a tug. By the time she opened the door, her fringe had drooped over one eye, her belt had loosened, and her left tit was about to poke out and say howdy if she hadn't rescued it. Focusing before her stood a kid with short blonde hair, his ears razored islands on the side of his head, standing to attention like a marine. He wore the white jacket with the horizontal epaulets that was the hotel staff uniform, and first impression was the whole guy seemed as starched as it was. Black slacks, straight as ramrods, black polished shoes at 6:30, the whole package making her feel even more sluttish and trashy. "Come in." The clockwork soldier entered with the tray. "Where would you like, please?" She waved indiscriminately. "Anywhere." "Very good, ma'am." Clipped. She tried to pinpoint his accent. European, for sure. Hungarian? She should be able to tell. Plenty of those at the studios. Fleeing the old country. Fleeing their wives, too, mostly. Now he was running out of ideas, she could tell. "Anywhere you can find a space." He balanced it on a footstool at the bottom of the bed, uncertainly, and wiped his hands on his behind as he backed away. She located her purse and spilled out some coins, picked up a few with her thumb and forefinger, and dangled them towards him until he held out his palm. He nodded his thanks for the tip, and, swear to God, a click of the heels went with it. In the mirror, she'd seen his eyes on the bottle of ruin. As his hand touched the door handle, she said, "Can I interest you in an illicit beverage by any chance?" The kid turned back, painfully polite and not a little nervous. "Thank you, but I do not drink." Eyes anywhere but on her. "You mean you don't, or you won't?" His cheeks flushed a little red, which she thought was sweet and a curse, a display of his unworldliness which must be a burden to carry into adulthood, poor sap, a kind of affliction. "Come on, live a little. You're a long time dead. You don't get any prize in the hereafter for being stone-cold sober, not according to the churches I go to." "I'm sorry, I should explain. The hotel, yes? I will be in a lot of trouble. In USA, this is against the law." "No kidding? What law? The law of the jungle?" "I'm sorry, these are the rules." "Oh, get the lead pipe out of your ass and enjoy yourself, kid. What's the worst that can happen? Nobody'll know. I won't tell, promise." She put on a Shirley Temple voice. "Cross my heart and hope to die." She genuflected, and he noticed her fingernails made little white lines in her skin as they brushed it just above the bra line of her nightgown. Her skin seemed soft and still had the sheen of sleep. He looked away. Turning from him, she filled her glass, then turned back to him and drank from it as if demonstrating the procedure. He looked at the coins in his hand and put them deep in the pocket of his slacks and didn't leave. She thought he was holding his breath, and maybe he was. She sat on the unmade bed and crossed her legs, positioning the glass on her knee. The hem of her nightdress rode up her bare, shaved calf. "You're German, aren't you?" He made an apologetic face. "My English is not so good." "Ditto." She smiled to put him at ease. "You're doing fine." She wanted him to smile back, and he did. "Where are you from?" "Bavaria, München, Munich." He pronounced it Moon-itch, like something you'd scratch. "In the south, close to the mountains."
"Yeah, we got those too. What's your name?"
"Peter."
"Peter," she repeated. "Hi, Peter."
Aged about 18, she guessed. He had a good 10-12 years on her. She liked that. She liked the young. There was something optimistic about them. They didn't know what was to come.
I better go.
No, Stay, she said. Talk to me. He laughed uneasily. You are a very nice lady, but I don't want to lose my job. You won't lose your job. I'm a guest. You're attending to the requirements of a guest. You won't lose your job. Sit down. Relax. Oh, please, fucking relax, Peter. Her language shocked him. That wasn't the way women spoke. Not what he was used to. It was another thing that surprised him about America. It made him feel a little sickened and a little excited at the same time. Okay, I sit. He could see what was attractive about her, even now, here, in this state, like some bedraggled bird with a broken wing, she had some quality. Downstairs, he had wondered if he would be able to tell that by meeting her, and he could, in an instant. It was true what they said, when they called them stars because they shone. What do you want to talk about? Oh, surprise me. The arm that propped her up slid down the bed. I haven't had human contact in 7 days. I'm adrift. I'm shipwrecked. Do you know what shipwrecked means? Of course. On an island. In stories. She rested the glass on her forehead. Not just in stories, baby. Baby was an American expression. He told himself she didn't mean anything by it. It was a term made by a boyfriend to a girlfriend in this country. It was strange, but it was okay. Have you ever been to an island? She asked. America is an island, he said. A big one, but an island. That's not what I meant. She flicked ash onto the carpet. I mean trees with coconuts on, big green leaves as big as this carpet. Beaches where no white man has ever trod. You get the idea. Tribes with plumes in their hair and bones through their noses who live in fear of their god, who sacrifice humans to him with the beating of dinosaur skin drums. She skipped her poison, her eyes not leaving him the whole time. That kind of island. The kid didn't know how to answer. Instead, he looked around the room, away from her, as if taking it in for the first time, or pretending to. You like this hotel? Oh, it's peachy. He took a step towards the door. I can get you something, perhaps. Sit down, for Christ's sake, Peter. I want company, that's all. I'm not going to eat you. For some reason, she laughed. For some reason, this tickled her, and she said it again while she was still laughing like a mule. I'm not going to eat you. He smiled so that she didn't laugh alone, but he didn't know what was so funny. He looked at her where she lay. Her flat stomach under the silk nightgown shook with mirth until she felt foolish and ceased. He was still looking down at her in silence, and she led him. The room was dark. Sirens broke the air like wild beasts in the distance. It made them both remember where they were and why. He coughed and moved to the curtains to open them. Don't do that. People can see in. I don't want them to see in. Talk to me. She bent her elbow to prop up her head, moved the glass to rest on the pinnacle of her hip bone. Talk to me. What do you want me to say? She cocked her head to where the light was trying to get in. Tell me what's happening outside. Outside? She took a mouthful of liquor and swallowed. What's happening to my lover? She blinked her eyes once, dreamily. He wasn't sure if it was the drink. She looked very sad and alone. He couldn't remember ever seeing someone looking so sad and alone. Her eyes hid back in their sockets like his grandmother's eyes. Tell me the truth. I can take it. Her breasts were tiny like a girl's, and the space created by the fall of the nightgown was too big for them. Afraid to go closer, touch her, break her, he leaned back against the wall as if he pressed hard enough, he might escape. But did he want to escape? A pencil line of sunlight from behind the drapes cast down his cheekbone, his throat muscle, one bicep, one golden button. The rest was in shadow.
The traffic is flowing again, he began tentatively. People are returning to work. President Franklin D. Roosevelt said in a speech yesterday that this great city might be bloodied, but was most certainly unbowed. He raised a fist, but she didn't look at him, and he wasn't sure she was listening as he spoke, but he spoke anyway, as he'd been bidden, hiding the fist again self-consciously behind his back. They are writing names on the walls of buildings, the relatives, parents, husbands, wives, writing the names of their loved ones, the ones who died in the slaughter. He saw her flinch a little at the word and kept his voice low. There were many, I think, over 70 on the subway train alone. Many, they say in the bulletins, are missing. Still, what are the words? Unaccounted for. The parents and wives and sons sleep on the streets now, asking anybody passing for information, for hope, I guess, or peace when the bodies are found. It is a funny word, peace. For a moment he was lost for something to add. He looked at her face as if it might offer him a hint, but it didn't. The rubble from the destroyed buildings has not all been removed. The trucks come and go through the night, but they are hills that do not seem to get smaller. It is a huge job, of course. The public services work like crazy around the clock to make stable the buildings they think might collapse and cause more destruction. Oh, and dust, yes, dust still hangs in the air out there. It doesn't go away. It clings to your clothes. You go outside in a black suit, and in 5 minutes it is white. Even funerals look like they have been sprinkled with icing sugar, figures from a candy shop. It's not right. He shook his head. When she looked up, his jaw was set. Meanwhile, the giant, he pays the price. The authorities, they are cutting and peeling off the skin from his arms in long strips and rolling it up like carpet, taking it away to turn into leather, so the rumor goes, for use as upholstering in government limousines. I don't know if you should believe the rumors. He wished that a little more light would fall on her, but it didn't. There is a beggar, he said, filling the silence. A bearded old Ashkenazer who sells souvenirs outside Macy's. You know the wind-up monkeys who play Klish, Klish? Not knowing the word in English, he mimed clapping his hands. The toys? He nodded. He has taken the Klish, Klish off them, so they look like little replicas of the monster opening and closing his arms. But if you look closely, you can see the little holes in the middle of their hands. I talked to him about the attack. He just shook his head and said it's biblical. It's biblical, he kept saying. A memory returned to him, and he recounted it quickly and with enthusiasm. Yesterday, when I walked past the scene, I saw a gang of children bouncing a basketball to each other, then tossing it high in the air, trying to get it to land in the dead beast's nostril. Younger kids on a dare were plucking out the monster's hair. It took quite a tug, I could see, and flicking them at each other like bullwhips. He chuckled. The actress said nothing and hardly moved, but she wasn't chuckling. He could tell that. His heart tightened in his chest. In the kitchen, they said it was you. I didn't believe them. She looked up. Do I look like the photographs? Aware of her appearance, she swiftly added, Don't answer that question. He laughed, shook his head in disbelief. I am in the same room as the woman who was held in the hand of a damn monkey. She lit a cigarette and left the packet sitting between her legs. He wasn't a damn monkey. He was a damn gorilla. He could see the curve of her thighs so clearly it was as if she was naked. He wanted to feel the silk and feel her skin. If it was cold, he wanted to warm it for her. If she was cold all over, he could hold her to his body. He was not cold. Are you German? You look German. She ran a hand through her curls and laughed.
I got news for you, kid. I'm not a natural blonde. He blushed to his bootstraps. Greek Scottish on my father's side, she said. Norwegian English on my mother's. Coat of many colors. Bella, she's a Pole who works downstairs washing dishes. She went with her sister and brother-in-law to see it. She was very excited. They all were, hopping up and down like they were going to a Broadway show, wrapped up in their scarves. She thought it would be somehow frightening, like a fairground ride. Fairground. Fairground ride. He nodded. Like Coney Island. Roll up, roll up. Go on. She said it wasn't. It wasn't at all. Eyes downcast, he looked unsure whether to continue. When she came back, she was real quiet, just put her frozen hands in water and got to work. Later, I asked her what happened, and she said the head of it was as high as 2 tram cars on top of each other. Huge. As big as a house. You could live in it, she said. Don't give them ideas, the actress thought, blowing cigarette smoke, then waving it gently from her face. They looked up, and they saw something catching the light. They couldn't work out what it was. Big, glassy, round. Then they realized it was a tear. Frozen. Turned to ice on the creature's cheek. Big as a glitter ball in a dance hall, they said. Like I say, they weren't laughing. They came back, like I say, real quiet. He shrugged. Then the kitchen got busy, 100 covers. We didn't have time to think about it after that. I don't know. What else don't you know? He looked up. Sorry? What else? He sighed. Captain O'Rourke and his men, the pilots of the biplanes, had dinner at the White House. He heard her make a little snort of disdain. Well, they are heroes, no? They risk their lives for the sake of the motherland. They didn't die, he did. The enemy. Enemy of what, exactly? I'm sorry, I don't understand. Shivering, she picked up the fur coat from the carpet and wrapped it around her shoulders. Did you see his silhouette against the sunset? He shook his head. Then you don't understand, she said, without any note of accusation, hardly louder than a whisper. Her throat was dry and needy. She struck a match and the lit cigarette dangled from her pale, dry lips, its tip bobbing as she spoke. Tell me about you. You have a family? In Germany. I will tell them I met you. Uh-huh. What will you tell them? You are famous. I am now. You are pretty. She laughed into a cough. Once upon a time. This room sure is dark. She wanted to ask him, was I pretty before I was famous? Do you have a girl, Peter? Sisters? 3. That's not what I meant. Sit next to me. You're a long way away. I can't see you over there in the gloom. When he did, she patted the mattress next to her for him to move closer, then did it again for him to move closer still. She placed her hand on his thigh and saw him shudder. Is my hand cold? Am I cold? He shook his head. She put it to his cheek. Will you take a drink with me? I don't like drinking alone. He didn't say no, so she held up the bottle of bourbon and pressed it against his lips. She tilted it up like it was a baby's bottle. Without moving his body, he took a mouthful and swallowed, and when the bottle was taken away, with a sucking noise, he gulped air. That's it now. You'll lose your job. They'll smell it on your breath. You've broken the rules, chum. I don't care, he said, tugging the bottle from her and swigging from it a second time, longer and deeper. She was astonished and had to take it, snatch it, from him before he demolished the whole bottle. Greedy little... down the hatch. What's it for, eh? Booze? She looked at the label. It swam. Just a way to get back to the animal. That's all, when you think about it. Look at us. Human fucking beings. We've got hundreds, thousands of years of fucking civilization. We've got intelligence and progress coming out of our ears. We've got motor cars and fashion and society and welfare and adding up machines and rotavators. And what do we need? When a man and a woman get together, we need something to evaporate all that, to get us back to the jungle, to wipe out history, to tear up books and wisdom, shed William Shakespeare, Homer, Jesus Christ, and Henry Ford, Abraham Lincoln, Greta Garbo, Thomas Edison, to be what we were, are, animals. She rose to unsteady feet in the middle of the swamp of sheets and pillows. What's a bed if it's not an island in the room? The island where we return to the past, the scary past, the exciting past, where we live or die on our instinct, on the blood pumping in our veins, not the whim of some bank manager or casting agent. We're at the mercy of the beasts that can eat us or save us or take us or raise us up to the shit, the heavens. The bed undulated under her. He laughed. Lady, you drink too much. And you don't drink enough. You better catch up. I'm way ahead of you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
You'll fall. I won't. She did. On her back, legs up from under her, landed flat, breathless, next to him, her hair dancing as the bedsprings whined like an orchestra tuning up. He leaned over and plucked each strand of hair from her face individually, an archaeologist carefully revealing a piece of precious treasure. The kid said, "I am not an animal." She smiled up at him.
"I was kinda hoping you were."
Her upside-down eyes glinted. He placed his hand on her belly and let the warmth spread out from him into her body. She didn't move, kept staring at the ceiling. She'd had plenty of men touch her before, boy and how. Hawk Sinnard, who took her to the creek and read to her from the Book of Genesis and told her if she held it a while, it would get bigger, and guess what? It did. 3 guys from Winslow who told her how come babies got cooked up and illustrated, one of them with a horde of pimples on his neck jumping out at her like frogs. The sweat and beer breath of a married guy named Ivan Ives. He quoted from the Bible, too, as he hitched up his 44-inch pants as if to convince himself of the fact. Grass stains on your summer dress, carpet burns and hickeys, such a catalog. The infections and insertions, all kinds, always, pleading, threatening, all wanting it, then wanting you gone just as fast. Life as a receptacle. That's the way you know it's going to be. Learn pretty fast in this world. She thought, that wasn't love. Not the love he gave me. How could you compare? He who owned all he surveyed, who knew no other of his kind, who stood alone, lord of creation, as far as the eye could see, he saved me from monsters, took me in his hairy hand and wouldn't let go, wouldn't let the demons get me, even when they buzzed him and struck him with their beaks and claws and drew blood, carried me through the vitriolic swamp like a cannonball, miasma smell making me heady and giddy as a child taking their first sip of champagne. He never let me fall. Held me up to his face, that big, dark wall, carnage breath wrapping me like a gift. Eyes black tunnels with a freight train coming. Swatted a pterodactyl. Picked my clothes off one by one. Peeled me like a grape. Examined me under the Hollywood chiffon, naked and white, to see me as I really was. Rolled me to and fro so he could look me over back in front. Blew at my hair. Gazed at me on wonder. Took me to his home in the clouds. And it wasn't about sex for once, because sex was impossible, and that made her so, so safe. And so, so happy then, in a lost world, far away, but found. She reached down to the kid's hand and held it, to stop it moving. She said, "I was dreaming of him when his hand came through the window of my apartment. Shards of glass rained down over my bed, and he hauled me out into the night sky. I thought I was still dreaming, because I was floating. I could hear the wailing traffic a million miles below, and the police cars whining, and the thunder of his growl getting louder in his chest as he climbed and climbed." She stopped. "Do you want to hear this?" He didn't say anything. He didn't move, epaulets hunched over her. She said, "I can still smell his hand, like a big black leather couch, the smell of a hothouse, of the Bronx Zoo, of a Mississippi swamp, of alligator gumbo, of nuts and palm trees and oil and dates and the blood of unsuspecting prey. And if I close my eyes, I can see my own reflection right now, frightened and amazed, pinned there in his big brown eyes." Her own unblinking eyes became baubles of tears, lost again. From the lost hand to lost love, her perilous journey, and now ashore, where the rivers were brake lights and the cliffs were Wall Street, and the toucan calls were extra, extra. "He was a wonderful thing. He was a god," she said. "I couldn't escape then, and I can't escape now, because he died for me. I know he did. He placed me down in a place of safety so that I wouldn't get killed when they came in that last figure of eight." She shuddered and hugged the fur tighter around her. "He knew what he was doing. He died for love. And nothing can ever be the same, because that day, when the stream of bullets from the airplanes tore into his skin, I died inside too." Her whole body wept. The kid touched her shoulder. She sat up briskly and unexpectedly and threw her arms around him and held him tight. At first he didn't know what to do with his hands, so he wrapped them around her. He could feel her ribs, her shoulder bones. He could feel her heart beating, like a frightened bird's you'd pick up in your hand, a damaged thing you'd want to save. The kid didn't want her to die. He wanted her to live. His fingers sank into her, shocking her. He held her by the shoulders and pressed his lips onto hers, into hers, forcing her head back sharply and mouth open and his mouth over it hard. Sucking the breath out of her, he twisted her and pushed her down onto her back on the bed. She was weak and frail, and it didn't take a fraction of his strength to overpower her. Was he overpowering her? No, because she wasn't resisting in the least. She simply lay there before him, her cage of a chest rising and falling quickly through the shimmering silk of the nightgown to catch her breath, eyes flickering like a doe deer brought down by a predator, startled, afraid, but the kind of fear, he thought, that meant excitement and desire and longing and lust and not stop, not no. If she meant no, she would say no. Sirens and car horns battled in the street a million miles below. He knelt across her, colossus, or so he thought, men, taking her hand and putting it on his full erection, coiled and pressing against the cloth of his slacks. She didn't like to take it away and hurt his feelings,
Without a sound, he furiously unbuttoned his jacket from the bottom to the top. In the dark, the golden orbs popped and flew. She watched the vest come up off over his head and saw that his emaciated chest had hardly any hair on it. Saw the smoothness, the pinkness of him. All she could think was, he shone. Then his pants were down, and her nightdress slid up in almost the same moment, as his weight dropped down on her. His back made a bridge, and he wriggled his hips till the tip of his thing breached her and went deep so fast she uttered a cry and dug her fingernails into his cold, doughy flesh. Not an expression of pleasure, but she'd learned that the male of the species liked this kind of thing. Her knees dropped aside. Memories tumbled on her in a barrage of the past, a wall crumbling on top of her she couldn't stop. He gripped her face and pushed it back into the sheets, smothering her with fingers and thumbs as she struggled to gulp air down her throat. She grunted and sobbed. Another requirement, thinking, why? What? How? And he was stabbing into her. A noble act, a heroic act, he thought. A redemption, a resurrection, yes. Yah, yawol. It was time she entered the world of the living again, and he was the man to do it. Do it. Do it. She would thank him. She would worship him. He'd be a god, and she'd be renewed and whole again and perfect and pretty and famous and fucked. And just as she was thinking, oh, God, I wonder if it's possible to enjoy this and not the pounding sweat of it, the grunting bourbon breath of it, the slow, numbing death of it, the disgust of it. It was over, and he felt the heat of fame washing over him, like reporters' flashbulbs going off, like Valentino's smile, like a tuxedo on fire. And she only felt the weight of him, the dead weight of him. And not that she didn't want it, but not that she did. And the Grand Canyon, like someone had hollowed her out with a big spoon, and the Grand Canyon being full of trash, which was where she belonged, said Papa, because that was what she was, and that's what she would always be. You hear me? But you asked me to, Papa. I believed you, Papa. He slid his penis out of her, thinking that behind her closed eyes and smiling lips, she'd rediscovered love. Papa? But she was thinking of the ape's tree-trunk finger pressing against her belly atop the Empire State Building, his ebony fingernail a tarnished mirror, his caress so gentle for a big guy. She rolled onto her side and hugged herself as the chill of the room returned. They want the story, she thought. Well, you know what the story is? The story is no man has ever come close to how I felt with him. On that mountaintop, on that skyscraper, with him at my side, towering so high, roaring as they came out of the sun. Stand in front of it, said Papa. Look right into the camera, said Papa. Look frightened, said Papa. Beautiful, said Papa. Beautiful. Beautiful. Would anyone scare me like Papa? Would anyone love me like Papa? Then she remembered the blood in her lover's fur, cloying, clammy, clotted. How he swayed from side to side in startled puzzlement, ageless. A sequoia hacked down, a century collapsing, a world destroyed, a country eradicated. How she wanted to communicate but could not. How she wanted to forgive him but could not. Save him but could not. How she wanted to be scared but fear was gone. His Majesty, His Highness, His... gone. She turned over and saw the German boy's head against the pillow and thought of the giant's head against the pillow of the sidewalk below, at the same angle, eyes non-focused in death. He rolled his head to her. It is what you wanted, yes? She paused before deciding to nod. He smiled and lit one of her cigarettes, and sat up, you could easily count his vertebrae, and stretched over to pick up his vest and hotel staff jacket, and dressed with his bare back to her as an airplane passed overhead with the monotone murmur of a disappointed voyeur. Oh, the pinkness of him. Her insides congealed. There was something inside out about the feeling, the nausea of stepping off a carousel, which was supposed to be an enjoyable experience but wasn't, and yet the relief of being off. She didn't want to think about it. He handed her his cigarette and lit another for himself. She considered the action unbearably familiar and unbearably arrogant. She wanted to cry again. He stood up, his shadowy cock, now shrunken and unattentive, dangling under the rim of his white jacket, and peeked behind the drapes at the afternoon sunlight. "Damn monkey," he chuckled as he buttoned up his collar. "We socked him good, huh?" She pulled the sheets around her in a nest. He got onto the bed on all fours and kissed her with puckered lips, which she endured. His grin was horribly self-congratulatory, and she wondered how much of this had been his purpose, to screw the actress in 7205. Perhaps he had announced it to the others as he picked up her tray. Perhaps he'd brag about it tonight in a bar. He had not been violent, and he hadn't hurt her even, as others had done. That was exactly it. She felt nothing. Nothing at all. There was a gaping hole inside her where he'd been, and it was as if it hadn't happened at all. And she knew with great clarity that was the way it would always be from now on. She sat up in bed with her breasts and knees covered. "I hope you don't lose your job."
"Screw my job," he said.
He was a different person now, as they always were, and it was never a surprise to her, but it always hurt.
"You know what they call me in the kitchen? Sauerkraut. This was supposed to be the land of the free, the home of the brave, of democracy and opportunity. I came expecting bright, clean Americans, like bright, clean American automobiles, not sweaty Turks tweaking my ass and blowing me kisses, and Italians barking and cursing at me, sticking my hand into boiling water for dropping a plate, a Jew begrudgingly giving me my stinking wages at the end of the week. I expected New York to be like an elevator, going up, always up, like the tall buildings, taller, higher, always higher, a place of money, a place of glamour and power and gasoline, not foreigners and perverts." He held his stomach in, puffing his hairless chest as he pulled on his slacks. "My father sent me here to learn the hotel trade. 1 year, he said, you will learn more than in any university. He owns 3 of the biggest hotels in Munich, 1 in Frankfurt, 2 in Berlin." He tucked in his genitals. "I always thought that the United States would be great, but it is not so great. I expected a strong country, but it is not strong. It is weak, a cripple like your president. You have no work, no good work. 13 million unemployed. Almost every bank is closed. People are losing their farms, homes, businesses. You have no money, no hope."
"We have movies,"
he snorted. "Which is what? Nothing but a sign of decadence." Threading his belt buckle, tugging it to the right hole and poking the pin through. "I have read the history books. This is the way empires fall. Look around you from your high buildings, and what do you see? The poor rewarded for doing nothing. Immigrants like me given opportunities while patriotic Americans struggle. Your country is sick, and your men are standing by watching it happen. They are not fighting for what they value. They are not fighting for the future. They do not have a leader powerful enough to make things change." The actress held her cigarette vertically with her fingertips and blew on it so that the tip glowed red.
"I'm going back home, not to Munich, to Potsdam," he said. "I have an uncle there, an industrialist. I know there is always a job there open for me."
He waited for a reaction from her, but all he saw was a long, glowing red puff on her cigarette. The blue smoke hung flatly in the air between them. He crushed his own cigarette out on the plate of cold, untouched food.
"Come with me. A new life, a good life," he said. "America, it is a place for dreams, but for some dreams you have to return to Germany."
She said, "I think there's a Potsdam up in St. Lawrence County."
The kid laughed through his nose at that. "Funny girl, crazy girl." "Stupid girl," said Papa. "I'm serious. Come. It is beautiful.
Beautiful. This way, to the camera. You're frightened. You're amazed. You're terrified. As the jungle drums began pounding in her heart, she imagined marrying this man. She could, so very easily. After all, he thought she was a star. He knew she was a star. You could see it in his eyes. He wanted that radiance of fame, of anecdote, of fable, to fall on him. He wanted to be larger than life, too. He wanted to have her on his arm, to show her off to bosses and officers and leaders, own her forever, and have her obey his orders. She could see herself making home with him in some little cuckoo clock house with deer buckheads on the wall, with parties hunting boar or gnawing chicken legs and swilling beer. Or a trophy wife in Los Angeles, she a star. The parts would come knocking, no jungle pictures. Him a screenwriter or producer or both. Kids, several. Nannies, English. Stern, but not too stern. He'd slap her occasionally, but only when she'd deserve it. He'd have affairs, but then so would she. He'd find some younger, prettier version. So would she. The divorce would be expensive. She'd get the children and dogs. He'd get fatter, bitter and twisted. Not necessarily in that order. "You know," she said, "I'm ready for breakfast now." He gave a broad grin, exposing his white, so perfect teeth. The parenthesis grin of a football player with a chiseled jaw. So American. "And some good, strong, black American coffee," she said. He picked up the tray.
"You are on the mend, yes?"
"Yes."
"I love you."
"Everyone wants to love you," said Papa on the boat during the voyage to the island. "And you know what? Let them." "I know," she said. When the kid had gone and the door was closed and she was alone again in the room, she imagined her lover's gigantic skull, polished and white in the lobby of the Smithsonian, surrounded by a party of eager schoolchildren, any one of them smaller than his pointed teeth, the skeletons of dinosaurs keeping a respectful distance, the stare of eons in the space where his beautiful eyes used to be. She got out of bed and took a sheet of hotel notepaper from the drawer. Sitting with her reflection in front of her, who was that woman with ribs in her chest you could count? Pale, gaunt, frightening. Why would anyone make love to that? She changed her mind and rummaged in her purse. She spiraled out her lipstick and wrote on the mirror, "Thank you, Peter." Thanking him for making it clear, even if he wouldn't understand, couldn't understand. Could anyone? Then she signed her name, her autograph. Maybe it would be worth something one day. "See, Papa, I'm worth something after all." She had to hurry now. It would only take so long for the elevator to descend and return. Light flooded the room like a bomb blast, so bright she had to cover her eyes. When she opened them again, blinking, her surroundings took on a different aspect, washed with color anew. It seemed she was in a different hemisphere now, a different latitude, the world upended, transformed, and rare. And she felt no longer weak and fragile and worthless. She felt strong and excited and loved. The drapes fluttered like flags horizontal into the room. She shed the fur from her shoulders. It gathered behind her feet. She knelt, then stood. Bare feet, bare legs, goosebumps, white skin. The kid with the whitest skin in school, so poor she couldn't afford shoes. Silk dressing gown, silk. How she'd moved up in the world. Clinging, a goldy sheen over the dark nipples and black V of her gender, invisible. Looking down at Ants, the way he looked down, like her lover, she felt no fear. The unnatural blonde closed her eyes, doll eyes, drums in her chest, took one foot from the window ledge, then the other. As it had to be, falling like he fell. 70 floors, 60, 50. Then the numbers floated away, irrelevant, like everything else. Wind raked through her frizzled hair, an ice-blonde blur as she dropped, pinioned by her plummeting. All her senses peeled away to reveal a peculiar kind of freedom, a strange kind of pleasure, that life would not be there to torment her very much longer. And that was fine. That was okay. A euphoric surge enraptured her. Thank God for that. And she prepared to enjoy her last few seconds on this earth, unencumbered by the future. And all she could think of was the smallness of it all, and the air rushing past, and that his mighty hand might catch her even now, and his mighty roar might yet echo in the canyon of the skyscrapers with the mighty beating of his chest. And he would save her, and they would be together on the mountaintop, because it wasn't like the paper said. Oh, no, it wasn't Beauty Killed the Beast. It was Romeo and Juliet. Of course it was. And that was how all great love stories ended, didn't they? Like this. What is the ape to man? A laughingstock or a painful embarrassment, and man shall be just that for the Superman, a laughingstock or a painful embarrassment. Once you were apes, and even now, too, man is more ape than any ape. Behold, I teach you the Superman. The Superman is the meaning of the earth. Let your will say, the Superman shall be the meaning of the earth. Nietzsche. Thus spoke Zarathustra.
All right, now I can say it. This story references possibly my favorite film of all time. I think I fell in love with Ann Darrow when I was, about six. This was after my parents took me to see a film in a tiny theater in a very small town in the East. The film was already a classic back in 1948 or whenever this was. It was about then. And it turned me into a fan forever of dinosaurs and giant beasts and terrifying heights. Thank you, Stephen, for writing this, and thank you for demonstrating the fact that horror doesn't end when the monster goes away. We bring our own darkness to our meeting with the creatures of the jungle dark. And by the way, yes, this is that Stephen Folk, the Stephen Folk who created and wrote the paranormal series Afterlife and the BBC TV Orson Wellesian Halloween hoax Ghost Life. Mr. Folk's latest feature film, The Awakening, will open in the U.S. in September. It stars Dominic West, Rebecca Hall, and Imelda Staunton. He co-wrote The Awakening with director Nick Murphy. He also did the screenplay for Gothic, one of Ken Russell's spooky... Ken Russell. And The Guardian, directed by William Friedkin. He's also written standalone scripts for Channel 4's Shockers and the BBC One's Ghosts, and won a British Academy Award for his short film The Deadness of Dad. I chuckled when I mentioned Ken Russell back there. Ken Russell was a director of so many films that affected me so oddly when I first moved to England back in the mid-60s or so. The very first thing I saw on British television when I entered my room for the first time, turned on the TV, and there were naked breasts on the screen. For a kid from America in the mid-60s, a naked breast on television was something you just never saw. It was a documentary that was done for the BBC about the dancer Isadora Duncan. So I've always really admired Ken Russell's work. And Gothic is a truly interesting film. Anyway, the reading of Stephen's story tonight is by Amy Sturgis. Amy is a wonder. She is an academic, a writer, an all-around really interesting person. I wish I could get her to do some of the fact articles for us, but Amy, alas, is a science fiction person, not a horror person. Ah, well. Coming up now will be 10 minutes of zombie joy. It's from the novel The Zombie Generation by Drake Vaughan.
The Zombie Generation by Drake Vaughan, Chapter 1. It had to be a fake, a ruse, a trap. Werner's first thought was to distrust everything, especially now that the figs had grown so vivid. That's what he called them, figs, short for figments. Sounded more pleasant that way. Reminded him of those dried, sugary fruits. Not that he tasted fruit in some time, and his figs were anything but sweet, chewy concoctions, more like old, soggy fries, appearing delicious until the rancid taste sliced across the tongue. This hallucination was no different. He snapped his eyes shut. Sometimes that did the trick. Just one long pause from reality, giving his head time to reboot. He found it worked best if he concentrated on something else, like standing on the beach at sunset or the sensation of eating a hot slice of pizza. But thinking about that stuff only made it worse. There were no more pizzas. Beaches were situated in the heart of the Deadlands, and forget about standing outside while the sun still crackled its rays. Perhaps that's why he didn't mind the figs. At least they added some color to the bleakness. And this one was brilliant. Evil in its hopeful charm, but brilliant nevertheless. He doubted the bugger he spotted downstairs would feel the same. Thank goodness the beast was sound asleep. A single glimpse of this would whirl it into a frenzy. Of course, the point would be moot if what he saw spread before him were only a fig. But considering its rarity and value, Werner had to assume otherwise. He opened his eyes. It remained. Damn. He peered left. Nothing. Then right. Again nothing. Nothing except it, shining radiantly from the center of the table. Right out in the open. His cure. It defied all logic. Yet there it was, clear as day. Well, clear as anything could be inside this unlit panic room. Werner flipped his night vision goggles. He had to witness this with his own eyes. Reaching into his left side holster, he yanked out the maglite flashlight. Its bulky mass weighed deep in his hand. He felt oddly unbalanced with the Glock 9mm still tucked away on the other side. He used that much more often than the cumbersome black flashlight. Werner froze. There was movement in the shadows to his left. Peering into the darkness, he saw it again. A brief whoosh as something fluttered across the wall. Why hadn't he spotted it with the goggles? Certainly the panic room wasn't large enough to hide one of the buggers. Yet right before him, he spotted a pair of gleaming orange eyes. He shot the flashlight towards them. The light splashed across the wall. Nothing, just the glossy surface of an electrical panel. Two red buttons poked from its side. Hardly eyes by any extent of the imagination. Only a fig, he told himself, waving the light across the room. Just another one of his crazy hallucinations. He wanted to feel relieved. Instead, he felt quite the opposite. Turning around, he slammed the panic room door with a sharp clank. It was louder than he'd hoped, especially with the bugger sleeping downstairs. He cursed himself for taking such a chance, although Werner didn't consider it a full day until he chided himself at least a half dozen times. Listening for any sounds coming from below, he gripped the Glock, but didn't remove it from the holster bed. It was a rarity for him to use it. Usually he just waved the gun around like some sort of magic wand, pretending to ward off evil spirits. There were numerous other and far less drastic ways to deal with the buggers. They were like any other animal, easily distracted, and only dangerous when cornered. At least when they were alone. Swarming was something else altogether, and nothing got those suckers to swarm faster than a gunshot, or any loud noise for that matter. From experience, he knew firing only peeved them, and when they were peeved, they were dangerous. Likewise, a single bullet hardly ever stopped a beast. Once Werner had witnessed a bugger lunge up onto a soldier after taking a headshot, just kept tearing into the poor fellow even as the soldier blasted another two rounds right into the beast's skull. Not that buggers have much use for their own brains, probably the reason they adored chewing on those of others. Still, Werner had yet to kill one. Not that he was opposed if it came right down to it. The choice between his life and a bugger's would be simple. But unlike other people, he didn't seek it out. Not to say he lived in peace. He just figured it was best to avoid warring with them. But he was no fool either, and always kept a gun handy. At first he loathed carrying it. He feared the mere act of holding a gun would transform him into one of those cocky, knuckle-dragging, ubo-macho jerks who bullied him his entire life. That was the excuse he'd given, but it was nonsense. Really, he'd just been afraid of shooting himself. When it came right down to it, Werner was pretty clumsy. Before the outbreak, he'd known next to nothing about firearms. His father, a card-carrying blue-collar sheet metal worker, had felt it best to shield him. told Warner that there were already too many battles in life and it was stupid to needlessly bring on more. Just surviving was an accomplishment in itself. But again, this was the same man who constantly bullied Warner and his mother, always under the swift threat of his fist. His father was hardly the one in need of self-protection, and he was always keen on saying that if there was a real war, not one of these silly adventures, empire building, that's what he called them, he'd be the first to arm up. Although, when it did come, Warner failed to spot him anywhere. Not that he wouldn't have minded the company. So when he realized he needed a gun, he settled on a Glock, mostly since he recognized the name and it sounded cool and powerful. Two things Warner definitely wasn't. Plus, unlike the others, it lacked the huge recoil that jerked his hand around like a puppet. The Glock was easy to aim, precise, and lightweight. And although he would never admit it, its small size fit snugly into Warner's stumpy hand. And for the first month he'd worn it, he'd walked around leaning to his left. That way, if it did unintentionally fire, he'd remained unscathed. This inane waddling soon became tedious, and after tripping and almost breaking his ankle, he'd finally given up. Of course, the gun never discharged. Not even the time when he'd lunged off that convenience store roof. And now, after all these long months, Warner could compete in the Olympics and forget he was wearing it. The gun, like every abominable thing in this world, had become part of him. Digging its roots so deep, he'd forgotten anything else had once grown there. After hearing nothing else emanating from downstairs, his hand dropped from the holster. There'd be no way he could miss hearing a beast of that size. Hell, the thing was so obese Warner doubted it could even stand up. Forget climbing to the second floor. Many buggers got bad in that way. The roads were peppered with them. Flopped across the ground, they just lay there, too fat to even roll over. It was sad and pathetic, but there was hardly a single thing about them that wasn't. Also, the bugger downstairs could just be a fig. He'd only seen one, and beasts were like cockroaches, almost never alone. Spotting a solitary bugger in the wild was as rare as a day without figs. However, when it came to the beast, Warner didn't take chances. To assume anything about a creature who could cleave through your skull like a banana peel would be the height of stupidity. Although no Mensa member, Warner was quite attached to his own brains. And if there was one thing in the world buggers enjoyed more than brains, it was the thing resting on the table right in front of him. The bottle's presence was confounding. It'd be similar to discovering that radio was playing, or that the internet was loading again. Hell, spotting a cow grazing in an open field would have given him less of a shock. Some things were just gone, and this was supposed to be one of them. Impossible. Of course, if it wasn't a fig, it was likely a trap. Warner knew plenty about bugger traps. At one time, the entire front yard of the safe house had been blanketed with them. Most were simple works bombs of Drano and tinfoil, inserted into 2-liter bottles. Adoring anything shiny, the buggers couldn't help from yanking them from the ground, especially when they sparkled in the bright daytime sun. And as soon as the contents bubbled together, kapow! These homemade bombs weren't fatal, but they did provide one hell of a punch, just enough to spook the beast and drive them away for a moment. But they always returned in greater numbers, which is why he had eventually abandoned them. Not that he desired a stronger bomb. He found killing usually only sparked more killing, especially when it came to the buggers. In pure numbers alone, that was a fight he couldn't win. Warner spun around. The muted sound was distant, similar to a neighbor slamming a door. It hadn't come from downstairs, but somewhere outside of the house. He waited for it to repeat, but when it didn't, he dismissed it as a fig. Wasn't the first time he'd imagined bumps in the night, and if it was a beast, he knew that there'd be more knocking. Once they started their pounding, they didn't stop until they either broke through or collapsed from exhaustion. He figured the fig had been sparked by the memory of those bombs. Sometimes it worked like that. He recalled that dreadful morning when a minor earthquake had set off all the bombs in an orchestral barrage. Christ, how they'd swarm afterwards, like a bugger D-Day up the hill, wave after wave of ravenous beasts galloping to investigate the noise. He still remembered the crunching march of their approaching footsteps. He'd given up on work bonds after that, but with the distractor up and running, the point was pretty much moot. And knowing how crazy they'd gone over those plastic bottles, he feared how the beast would react catching a single glimpse of this. Whoever had placed this liquor bottle inside the panic room couldn't have found a more glimmering lure. A fact which made Warner ever more wary. He couldn't just leave it, though. Not after everything he had endured. Trap or not, it was his. He'd earned that much. Finders keepers. In a lawless land, the simplest codes ruled. And to be fair, it was his cure, not theirs.
The Zombie Generation by Drake Vaughn is now available in both electronic and paperback versions at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Thank you, Lawrence.
And you're quite welcome, Drake. A few words. For over a decade, Drake Vaughn has been employed in numerous facets of the entertainment industry. He now resides in Santa Monica, California, and writes full-time. The Zombie Generation is published by Dead Orb Press and, as he says, is now available. And go to Amazon for more information. Put in Drake Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-N, or The Zombie Generation. And if you want to have 10 terrifying minutes of your book or your story voiced here in the Nook, just do what Drake did. Record it, send it to us at talestoterrify@gmail.com, and put 10 terrifying minutes in the subject line. And there we have it. A few dollops of information, an ad, a story of depth and heart and sorrow and, yes, horror. And 10 terrifying minutes of zombie apocalypse. And that was our evening together. And now it's time for you to consider how you'll make it home on this jungle night. It's midnight. It's still 89 wet degrees out there. Here, well, here, it's comfortable, of course. Mahler, the ink-black cat of the Nook, hasn't been seen lying on his back with his feet in the air all day, so we'll let you out. You'll swelter for a while. Why don't you take a cab tonight? You'll arrive home refreshed. You'll draw some cool liquid. You'll mop your brow. You'll stand in the dry, chill wash of the air conditioner. And you'll think about poor Ann Darrow. And tomorrow, you'll pull the film from the library, your library. The 1933 or 2005 versions, please, not the one from 76. Though that one does have that rather ecstatic moment where the ape washes her, Dwan, I think she's called in that one. He washes her in the waterfall and then blows her dry. Yeah. Yeah, and you'll watch it with new eyes. Of course, that will be after a night of sleep and naturally, pleasant dreams.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.